Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 12th, 1998, and this is the second in a series by Paul Olson, and he's in the fireside room this evening. His session is going to be about why read junk? Good, bad, or great? Does it matter for our faith? It considers the creation and fall stories again of Genesis, followed by a brief discussion of why we like certain TV shows or current movies, and why we don't. Then we will discuss what makes literature great and how we know the difference. And this is OLP 98-2. So let's go to the fireside room for discussion and lecture.
This is a literature session on why do I read such junk, or how to tell good from great and good from bad about literature. I don't have any answers to that, but maybe you will. And my name is Paul Olson. I brought some books I just grabbed out of the library. John Grisham's The Chamber. Anybody read it? Anybody read a Grisham novel? You know, okay. Any read any Minchner novels? I wrote The Covenant. I found that in there. Richard Wright's Native Son. Anybody read a Richard Wright novel? Here's one. Fyodor Dostoevsky, The Brothers Karamazov. Really? Wow, way to go. How many pages is that bugger? And I brought William Styron's Sophie's Choice, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, I think. This last spring, Augustana is on a quarter system, or three equal terms. Two colleagues and I brought to fruition an argument we'd had a couple of years ago. And the argument began, I walked into one colleague's office and said, you know, I think Styron's Sophie's Choice might be the greatest American novel ever written. And the comment from one colleague was, well, we better talk about that. And of course, he didn't agree. And another colleague I told the same thing to, and she said, well, I read that a long time ago, and I'm going to read it again. And when she finished reading it, she said, this is a person who's a University of Chicago PhD, kind of an expert on Moby Dick, said, well, that might be right. It might have even surpassed Moby Dick, and that's kind of among American literature people. Moby Dick is kind of the classic, I guess, or one of them anyway. Though there's debate about that, of course, too. Well, the three of us taught a course called My Best Book Ever, and it just filled right away with seniors and non-English majors who wanted to figure out what does it mean to have the best book. And after 11 weeks with those students, we decided we didn't know. But I said, I'm going to go to Holden Village, and I know they'll figure it out up there. So that's your opportunity. I thought the way we would go about this is so that we can look at something that we've all shared in common, is to start very briefly with some television program or movie that's out that maybe lots of us have seen. Then go to something that we've also shared in common, and that it's short enough that I can share it with you again, the creation story in Genesis, and look at that as, is it good literature, and how do we decide that? And that's the questions. Those are the questions that we'll address. So, I'll start by asking you, name a couple of your favorite television programs or current movies that are popular enough. I mean, don't pick a foreign film, I think, unless it's something that everybody's seen. But it's popular enough that maybe many of us have seen it. A really good TV show. Your silence is telling, speaks loud. Is there one? Or just one, if it isn't good, we're not in any academic prestige game here.
We like Tuesday Night Jag. It's called Jag.
Jag.
Judge Advocate.
What is it?
It's called Judge Advocate General. It's a military show.
Oh, okay. Have many people seen that?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sure? Okay.
Sure.
So, military, and we've got two people. Okay, that doesn't mean it's not good. It just means we... Okay, any others?
Seinfeld.
Okay.
Murphy Brown.
What?
Murphy Brown.
Murphy Brown. Keep going.
Coach.
Coach.
Home Improvement.
Home Improvement.
Chicago Hope.
Chicago Hope.
ER.
Monday Night Football.
Monday Night Football.
Biography.
What? Biography.
Masterpiece Theater.
Okay, and then we'll list a lot of different plays that we could consider. Let's just stop there, just to expedite this whole thing and get to our conclusions, maybe. Anybody up here look at these and say, that is absolutely awful?
Some of them.
Then we'll duke it out right up here.
Well, I don't say that, because I just simply don't watch TV unless there's something really extraordinary. So
okay.
I haven't seen anything like that.
Okay.
I think people watch television as kind of an escape. You know, it doesn't have to be heady or intellectual. Sometimes
so they're not looking for something great.
So something kind of a temporary escape.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This might not work at Holden Village. I mean, typically, a lot of people here probably don't spend, you know, hours in front of that boob tube, and this whole pedagogical approach will fall flat on its face. But that's okay. We'll move on. Is there anything here that we can conclude about our process of deciding what to watch? I mean, what criteria do you have? And it might just be, I'm going to zone out for a while, and that's acceptable, of course.
Most people are embarrassed about the junk they watch, so they wouldn't say it and put it up there.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
If you watch junk, you're not going to say it. You're going to say, oh, I watch Masterpiece Theater.
Yeah. And we know you watch The Simpsons. Although I hear they're great. I don't know. Well, again, if this doesn't work, I'm ready to move on with something considerably. We'll go to Scripture. TV to Scripture. There's a leap for you. Can we say anything about the stuff that we have picked as, I think this is good, you have said. What would you say about it that makes you turn it on again if you've seen it once?
How much it makes you laugh. I mean, that most of the comedies in there.
That's really interesting. That and very good. That a lot of these are comedies. Murphy Brown, Seinfeld, Coach, Home Improvement, Monday Night Football.
I guess on Murphy Brown, she did take us places we didn't always want to go. She took me places I didn't always want to go. Let me do it that way instead. But she had some credibility built up, I think, with the ability to entertain. I mean, because she ended the whole thing with breast cancer and dealing with.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting observation that one of the things that you've said that we look for is we're going to go places we've never been before. And you can see what we're getting at is what are the criteria for deciding is something, is it good? Is it we want to come back to it?
You're drawn into a relationship. You're introduced to people that you kind of care about, and you're curious to see what's going to happen in their life. You know, you can either relate to them or you're just drawn into the characters. Some people.
I know, so I like to find things that people that I can relate to some extent, but not too closely, or it no longer becomes entertaining.
Yeah.
If it hits too close to home, I often will turn it off.
So that's very interesting and painful if it is that. Good.
I think it also takes us places where we already are. It reflects the human experience, so we see the pain or the joy that are like manifest in our own lives. I didn't particularly enjoy the show Roseanne, for example, but I watched it sometimes and I always appreciated the way it showed me what it does mean to be laid off. What does it mean to work under an oppressive situation? What does it mean to be in a family that's not at all like mine? And yet, that's humanity there.
Yeah, I'm going to add, you said that well. Am I fair in saying diversity and complexity of human experience? I mean, it's an experience, a human experience, you have probably, I'm guessing, never been laid off, maybe.
And yeah, I have been. And
you appreciate Roseanne more?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. And then other parts of it look like you said, I mean, I can't watch, I'm going to be really revealing here because I watch a lot of television. I don't like to watch Mad About You because those people are too happy. And they're too in love, and I don't have that. And so I don't watch that.
Well, then I'm going to add another word here that comes out of this. Reflects. We've got diversity, complexity, and the reality of the human experience. We probably, I suspect, I mean, America does, likes James Bond. I mean, that's high action stuff, and it's exciting, and it's adventurous, and that, you know, it's imaginative. That strikes a part of our being. But it's not the thing we're going to turn to when we're troubled. Boy, I heard you say that, you got me a James Bond movie. I mean, you're not going to do that. Because it isn't reality, is it really? I mean, you know, the guy can't die. Yeah, good. Other things.
I find myself being one of those people who doesn't like Seinfeld. Sorry.
Yeah. You are alone. You are not alone.
And one of the things that bugs me is I've heard it said it's about nothing. And that's part of it. It's like all it is the mundane things that happen in everyday life. Why would I want to spend 3 hour or you know an hour watching TV about nothing? Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to have some entertainment. It's got to reflect some reality, but there's got to be something in it that's entertaining at the same time.
Whatever it means, you used the word substance. It's got to be substantive. Whatever that means, and that's part of what we're going to get at. You know, and of course. I think that the purpose of this class will be not to agree on something, but to go through the process and to awaken a consciousness in our mind of why is it we come back to stuff? What does it say about us as human beings? Not just as literary students, but as just the big general phrase, what does it say about us as human beings to that these are the criteria we use to come back to something, to be touched by something, to be maybe even, heaven forbid, changed by something. well, good. Anything else?
I like Dr. Quinn. And
okay.
I think one of the reasons why I do is not only this relational situation that somebody mentioned, but that it's an earlier age, something about that time span, and I think it has some redeeming features of plot, stuff that happens within the program. And I think maybe the fact that it's earlier times a little more simplistic, not so complex, and I'm really upset about the fact that there's going to be either a military or a police, something that has to do with violence and more like some of what we're living through right now, in place of it this next season.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Quinn is gone?
Yeah. Unless it's taken up by another station. Mm-hmm.
That's a big joke around our house. Any TV show we really like, we're afraid to get too excited.
We know it's going to be gone.
So I hear you.
It's probably true for all of us. Yeah, yes, what is your name? It's my wife.
I think one of the reasons that ER and Chicago Hope draw so many people in is because of the issues, when we talked about issues and substance, but it's the medical ethics and the drama of life, death issues, and death and issues of health kind of intrigue us all, and as hospitals sometimes seem like a foreign place, and that gives us a look into those issues that we all wonder if we're going to be part of, being having a disease, being in the ER, getting a long-term illness, medical ethics.
Yeah, that's really good. What else could you say to your wife? I summarized that in life and death are essential and common to all of us issues. Some of the issues that these different programs raise, and which is why sometimes I suppose Chicago Hope and ER aren't so good, or they don't entertain us as much, or touch us as much, because they're not as essential or as common to the human experience. And this also, you know, substantive, essential, they're abstract, up for grabs words, right? I mean, what is essential to one person isn't going to be essential to somebody else. And that's the fun of doing this, and we're going to strike a chord, I think, that'll hit home in a moment.
Someone said relationships, and I think that has a lot to do with character. I mean, some people, the world is divided into those who don't like Seinfeld, and that is, I think, because you either like those people or you don't. And it's really easy to not like them. Mm-hmm. And yet, some people do like them, and they become, I mean, this is kind of scary, but they're sort of like friends of ours. Or on any of these other shows where the people that I felt like I was actually in a relationship with were those people in Northern Exposure.
Oh, yeah.
And I
sure.
felt like I didn't want them to go away. Because yeah, right. I would lose these important friends.
You went through a grief process when the show went off.
Yeah. Well, it's not the only time, but it's the best example because there was like a community that I was taking part in, actually. Yep. It was sort of like Holden. So the characters that you actually sort of form something like a relationship with it, that's a factor. The drama, the substance, the plot isn't really relevant if it's about the characters.
Did anybody watch the show Nothing Sacred?
Oh, yeah.
But for some people, that was just a wonderful show, and I was one who absolutely loved it because it kind of showed the reality of the church. It gave clergy you could relate to. It gave parishioners that you both wanted to love and strangle at the same time, which was also very real. And I think some people were threatened by that because it was almost too real. It was almost too real.
Yeah.
You know, again, one of our shows that went off the air.
I have to deal with that in real life. Why would I want to watch more of it?
And it's like, and Paula, my husband and I, who's also clergy, we were kind of surprised that we were so drawn to it because a lot of times, you know, like I said, that's like watching work. But we were drawn to it because it says, wow, that's exactly what I'm feeling, or I can relate to Father Ray. You know, it was neat.
Yeah, well, you've given lots of good examples, and we've come a little bit toward, quite a ways, in fact, towards deciding what is it about these pieces of entertainment, I was going to call them literature, because we'll go to that. What is it about this stuff that attracts us? And what is it about the stuff? And the other part of the question is, of course, what is it about us? And in answering that, we learn something about ourselves and our journey on this human experience. Well, we've summarized some of these things very well. And let's just, we could go on forever about this, and that would be okay too, but let's go to a kind of a strange story that has lasted for thousands of years. That is the creation story in Genesis. And to expedite that, I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to read part of it. And just to remind you of the what you probably all know, is that in the creation story of the universe, we have two different accounts, and chapter 1 of Genesis is pretty different from chapter 2. We'll look at part of that. Just to hear it again, and as we did last night with the Adam and Eve story, see if you hear something different. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. How would you characterize just what I've read? Without void. I mean, without form and void. Darkness.
And a chaotic darkness.
Chaotic, yeah. And it's one of the words in some translations that is used, in fact. This is chaos. And what does chaos mean to us? Just that word, the English word.
Lack of order.
What?
I said the same thing.
Okay.
Out of control.
I mean, I think I'm going to write these down, because this is the beginning of this story is about chaos, and you've called it lack of order, out of control, and anything else that might add to that, or are we okay?
A sense of emptiness.
Emptiness, and you said, I'm going to write the word sense in there, a sense of emptiness.
What about too much? Is there a lot too much?
Sure. Too much. I'm going to jump ahead here with some clues about one way to take the story. Is that, do these phrases ever apply to your life? Well, that's the answer. Everybody laughed. Have you ever had a lack of order in your life? Has it ever seemed like it's been out of control? Do you ever have a sense of emptiness? And does it ever seem tumultuous in one's life? And what I'm already introducing to you is that how do we read this story, and what is it that we look for as what makes this story last a long, long time? What makes it so dear to people that they take it to court on how it should be interpreted? It's been to court in Louisiana, in Maine, in Texas, California, Louisiana. The whole Scopes trials in 1929 are about that. And there were lots of state acts throughout the country during the Scopes trials times to somehow defend a particular way to read this story. So it's pretty dear to us. I've been teaching English for a long time, and no one has ever taken my interpretation of Huckleberry Finn to court. They don't care about it. No one's ever taken my understanding of Sophie's Choice to court. But this book, this story, has gone, and that's an interesting thing in our life and in our American culture. Well, so with all that this story is dear to us, we've already identified something about all human beings. And it's a different look at this story that has not so much to do with the scientific order of creation, but something about humankind and something about humankind's, as we'll see in a moment, relationship to this creator. Now, I bring that up to suggest, do these kinds of notions in this story strike us more poignantly or as poignantly as some of these conclusions did about our television programs? Do we pick up and read the creation story and say, I really want to know how woman was created? We're not going to read Genesis to do that. Or if we do, we're going to be confused because we got two different accounts. So something else is going on there, and I'm just going to keep asking you, what do you think about, or what do you hear, feel, that maybe you didn't before? Okay, we just read all of this. It's lack of order, it's out of control, there's a sense of emptiness, it's tumult. Then, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. I'll stop. What do you feel or hear?
Someone's in control.
Somebody's in control. The chaos begins to end.
It's like the lights come on after a nightmare.
The lights come on after a nightmare?
Dawning.
Comfort. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Anything else? And there was light. About what?
If you're looking at it as a form of literature, it's not much plot there. There's no rising action. It's just this happened, then this happened.
Yeah. And what do you make of that then, if you're looking at it as literature? That there is none of this build-up. It's just, God said there would be light, and there was light. I mean, we can go to the Interpreter's Bible and look at the P accounts and the J2 accounts, and I mentioned that last night, and all the different scholarly looks at this, and that's appropriate, and it's good, as I said last night. But we don't have all that beside us today. All we have in front of us here is this story, as it is, this piece of literature. Now, the fact that it is scripture shapes a lot of what we bring to it. But if we can set that aside for a moment and just, what is the story doing? We have something that happens pretty fast, in that there seems to be some order all of a sudden, and God said there to be light. And any other reactions that you have to that? Is it hard? And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
Very simple.
What?
It's very simple.
Light.
And for him.
It's simple for him, for it, for this God. Light is simple. What else did we say? Order is seems to be coming. Did I hear comfort? Did somebody say that?
Comfort,
we heard that word.
There's a sense of power.
Power? Yeah, I guess.
You can see something.
Who else can do that?
You can see something. Before it was so dark.
Ooh, this is our... And let's go back to this. Has anyone ever thought in their individual life, boy, this is darkness. Abyssal night, Styron calls it.
You have to
sleep
with
a
light on.
Yeah, good. So power in the dark, and now there is light, and now it's kind of metaphorical as opposed to just the weak thing we can see. Well, and God thought the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and I'm going to go fast so we can discuss some other ideas about this. And then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and you know this story, how it unfolds. But I'm going to skip ahead. Now, it's verse 3 that God said there to be light, and there was light. And then it's 11 verses later, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. In between, we had, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants, What do you do with that? What do you hear or feel? I'm asking you that maybe you didn't hear or feel before.
Well, a good mystery novel will bait you up here and then bring it back later, and it's almost like this first is an introduction to be further explained later in the chapter.
That's good. A lot of literature does that. So let's go back now to see if that's an assessment that makes sense and adds, it fits in the whole story. Is this a foreshadowing of something later? I mean, you heard it. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And then 11 verses later, let there be lights in the... And so one account for that is, the writer is foreshadowing the part of creation. My wife can walk out, but you guys can't. Yes, you can.
It makes me wonder where the light came from initially. The sun and the moon and the heavenly bodies that we take as producing light didn't come until further on in creation. Where did the light come from initially, and what was the light? Maybe it's something other than what we think of as light.
Well, now, what does that all mean?
I don't know.
It's a great question, and my question is to enhance the complexity of your question. Do we wonder where that light came from? Or what are we really talking about? What do we hear? And you have no criticism, literary criticism beside this, no biblical exegesis beside you. All you have now is this story, and light got created before the sun did. And I'm confused. And you are too.
It just occurs to me as we're talking about this that I did grow up in church. I mean, it always was around me. So it's the kind of thing I just have always taken as being true.
What is that? No, I'm going to stop you. True means?
Well,
historical, scientific?
Whether I true is just true. Whether I understand it or don't, and it's not troublesome to me, what I'm thinking of is if I'm reading a book, if they don't give me enough background to catch up on what the story is, I'm thinking, what is this? But with this, it's like, okay, I don't need all the details. I mean, I personally look at all this differently. And as I'm not a scientific person, so I trust the scientific community to worry about what needs to be, you know, what they need to. I'm not troubled by that. But just as we're talking about this, I thought, it has never occurred to me that this wasn't true. I don't care if it was 7 24-hour days, 7 million years, the story's still true.
Yeah, well, that's a great word and a great application for this whole process. And I'll differentiate something for you. The true and facts may not be the same thing. and the historical. And as soon as we get that concept in mind, the Bible is a different book. I would contend it might be a better book if we continue to look for truths. And I mentioned last night that it's Don Quixote who says, facts are the greatest enemy of truth. It's the facts of this story that have gone to court. Mm-hmm. And every time you take the facts to court, as I listen to what goes on in those arguments, and I've read what they've taken to court in Louisiana, I mentioned the places, I think they're missing the truths of this story. So the story is true, but we've got this one fact that light was created. It's a little bit strange there. Well, then, if this were a television program, that's why we started with this, we would turn it off. This is silly. This is unrealistic. This is stupid. This doesn't add up. I'm not going to read this anymore. And yet, for 6,000 years, we've got this story there, maybe just because pastors require it.
I'll admit I just came in, but don't we have to remember that these are stories that people came up with to explain things that they wanted explained, and they didn't have the scientific means that we have at our disposal to determine facts. So they made up what they thought seemed logical, reasonable, and went on from there.
Yeah, that's a great observation, and there's a whole body of literary criticism called historical criticism, which means we're going to put this story in an historical context and explain it that way. And that's legitimate. And it's appropriate, and it's good, and it's helpful, but we don't have that history. We don't know what those, what I'm talking, there's another kind of criticism in literature called formalist criticism, where all you have is the text. You have no help. The text, and what does it say to me? And that's kind of what we're doing, is that formalist criticism, and it's one, and again, the historical criticism, the morality criticism, there are lots of different kinds that we can apply to this, and they all work. But right now, what we've done, at least that's how we started the television programs, what is it about this story as it is here, we have no sidebars of explanation, that connects to us?
I think a lot of this, the way we define chaos, shows up in a lot of TV shows. Someone was talking about health issues and death and the panic that's happening whenever there's... I don't watch a lot of violent shows, but you know, there's always people fearful, scared, running. Mm-hmm. And then there's the issues of the ER, and then there's the crazy things that happen in relationships and families. And so this is manifest in TV, I think. How it resolves is probably different. I don't know.
Yeah, there we go. Let's run with it a little while. If we're going to say this, that lack of order, out of control, sense of emptiness, and tumultuousness, and darkness is present in the lives of these television programs, how is it resolved in those television shows? In an hour. anything else? Just throw some concrete illustration out.
It almost always ends up good.
It's always good.
Yeah. Happy ending. The whole idea of it has to have a happy ending.
Not
always. But I'm thinking of...
Often.
In the sitcoms, yeah.
In the sitcoms. But there's also a traditional... I'm trying to think, how can I say this quickly? We're from Alaska, and one of the traditional ways of telling stories, at least in the Inupiat culture, is to end it with tafai. That's all. As close as a ending as I can think of, or as translation I can think of. Tafai. That's the end. That's all. And one story, I heard the story of a storyteller who was telling a very common story to a white audience, and instead of ending with tafai, she always ends this story with, and then they got married and lived happily ever after. Because she knew that the white people that she was telling the story to, and she's an excellent storyteller, knew that that's how they expected their stories to end. So being a very, very adaptable person, realized she needs to put that ending on the end of her story so that they hear all the rest of it and it ends in the right way. So instead of having the tafai, it was they got married and lived happily ever after. And I think some of our TV programs tend to put that ending on the end, and they lived happily ever after. Not always, but when you think of some of the really great endings of a series that everybody really talks about and really likes, often they're positive ones, or at least ones where you can see a continuance. You can see where they went on with their lives and it was a good thing.
So no. Some kind of
everybody
resolution.
Died. The whole world ended, and that was the end.
Yeah. There's some kind of resolution, and we like the happy ones. Well, what would you say about the response in this story to this stuff? Obviously, that's not a good question.
When you were reading the first part of Genesis, in my mind, I knew I was thinking darkness because I knew that light was coming. And as a Christian community, I mean, often we just associate, we accept it as true, that light is coming, and we know that that is thought. So we don't put it into the fact form in our mind. I mean, the foundation is laid that we accept the light as truth or God.
Light equals truth.
So we don't, I mean, in my mind, I don't even think sun, moon, light in that aspect.
So that the way that you, we've already started this, of course, the way that you would look at this story isn't really grounded in scientific or historical fact. There's something else going on.
Right.
And is that, does it speak, yeah, the story, does it speak then to us, having that in mind, differently than it speaks to us if we're going to take it to court and prove these facts and this is what you have to teach your school children? Well, without going back to the story, we've had enough, and we've even got controversy going. What are some of the truths in this story? The truth is, women were created after men. True? I didn't read that part, but what do you know of the two different creation stories? Women were created out of the rib of a man. Truth? No. Not unless somebody who edited this book put these two stories together and left those two major contradictions there. The first contradiction is that not even the order of creation is the same in the two stories. And in the first one, plants and animals are created, and then male and female together, he created them together, you know, a different order. In the second chapter, we have man is created, then a whole bunch of other things, let's find a helpmate for him, and the cows didn't work and the birds didn't work. So finally, we rip out a rib and have a woman. So what's true? I guess as students of literature, we look at the things, the truths of the story, not the facts of the story, and maybe it speaks to us with something richer than we ever thought it did at first. Can this be a story about the human condition? And, okay, think about that, and then ask some questions and give some answers to what are the truths of the story. Maybe it's easier to list, and I can do it quickly, the facts of the story. One fact is that man is created, or man and woman in the first one. Another fact is man, and then we could list these things. I'm not going to do that just in, to save time, too. The order of creation is different. So obviously the facts, I mean, somebody's telling us, aren't they, with these two stories that are so contradictory, don't get hung up on these facts. Or at least then let's make this ambiguity unambiguous. Let's clarify this. But it's left there on purpose. So you're right, it seems to me, and you're reading well, when light is something else then. So then let me suggest a truth of the story, and then you run off with some more. One of the truths in the story is that God brings light into the life of God's people. When there is a lack of order and order, and we are to control as a sense of emptiness, and what else can end the darkness? Home improvement? I mean, think of the resolutions that are done there. I like the show too, I've seen it twice. That was okay. I'm one of those who I've watched, and my kids say Seinfeld is great. I've watched it twice, and I'm sorry, I never laughed. And they just say I'm weird, you can too. The resolutions that we saw in these television programs are different than the resolution here. What else is true? Again, without reading this, so I can move on to some other questions in literature. What else is true about these creation stories? What would you say?
Man is the dominant prize of the creation.
Humans are the prize of the creation. Arguable, but a truth. What else?
Men and women are differentiated.
Men and women are differentiated. True. What's God like?
Omnipotent,
pretty powerful. Let there be light. Let's create animals. And is God the creator? Is this writer an agnostic? You know, does he wonder? You know, I wonder what God is like. And he's pretty, and I can say here, there, pretty safely, I guess. He is pretty sure about God. God is omnipotent. He's a creator. As the next story goes on, he's loving, he's forgiving, he's full of mercy. All kinds of things you can say about this God. Those are truths. And then the facts that we pulled out of that tell us something different. And is that, are everybody with me? That the ambiguity and the contradiction of these facts is there on purpose to suggest pay attention to these truths. And you did that very well. This is what's going on there at the beginning. Well, is this a great story then? And would it be a great story if it were like some of those people do who take it to court? If this, let's pretend this is a scientific account of creation. This is how it began. Is it defensible? I mean, on day one, light was created. I want you to understand that. And on day six, whatever it is, 11 chapters later, or verses later, the light-giving bodies are created. Scientifically explainable.
It doesn't really make sense, scientifically.
No, it doesn't make sense.
And it is missing only that there was a certain order.
Yeah, God brings order to this chaos and this lack of... And then we talk about, as you started out with, is this an individual's life? What can bring order to chaos in the humankind's life? This writer believes God can.
Isn't the one of the ways that you establish a scientific fact is that you can reproduce what you've said happened?
Mm-hmm. And this would be tough. Yeah. Good. Well, the reason I use this story is to suggest to us that we have some ways that we read, and we have some criteria that we establish as we go back to stories, and that the truths of stories strike us in different ways. The truths of television programs strike us in different ways, so we agree, to disagree about what's good. I would contend that this story of creation is a rich story, and it gets up there where we can call it great literature. But what defines great literature? What defines the great television program? What does it take to be great? Scientific accuracy? You've all said no. What does it take? Now, this doesn't have memorable characters, really, like Sophie's Choice or Huckleberry Finn or Moby Dick. And that could be a criteria. But just in this story, what does it take to be valued as this is really worthwhile?
It's durable. It's lasted over a long period of time.
And that's its proof. And why is it durable?
I think because it makes you think. I mean, there's more to it than what you can see at just face value. And that's why I consider great literature is something that I have to, if I close the book, I just sit and think about it and find greater truths. Afterward.
Yeah. So let's list some of these and then move on to and you will use your phrase, greater truths. Captain Ahab says, he calls it the pasteboard mask. We have to go, in Moby Dick, we have to go beyond what we see into areas of that are beyond anything that we have ever existed, the pasteboard mask. There's something beyond that. greater truths. What else?
Something we can identify with.
And what do you identify with in the creation story?
The chaos.
Yeah, all of this, don't we? Yeah. So, personal identification. Well, let me share something with you. John Grisham's The Chamber. Good book. How many people have read something of Grisham? I asked this before. Do you like Grisham? Would you read more than one? Good stuff. What's good about it?
Intrigue, I think.
I'm going to make another category here. Intrigue. What else?
It made me think about the issue that he was dealing with.
There are issues.
I felt about it.
Yep.
Personally.
There's enough action and intrigue that it draws you. It keeps moving. It's got a sense of movement in it.
So the plot.
You turn the page.
Yeah, the plot has something to do with whether we like it or not. Good.
The development of of that main character, or the character who ends up in the chamber, the way your view of him changes in the course of it.
The complexity of
the complexity, that's the right word.
Yeah. We all know characters that are, read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the characters aren't, they're pretty much superficial, and there's a phrase for that in literature, caricatures. Okay, intrigue that deals with issues, the action in the plot moves us, the complexity of the character.
I like the whole part of the protagonist, the young lawyer, trying to uncover the unsavory past of his ancestors.
So, is there some, the unsavory past, are we attracted to some kind of moral issue? Is there some kind of higher morality or a moral consciousness that's raised in us that matters? I mean, is that fair? I mean, if it didn't, I'm just going to write this down. I'm going to use the phrase, a higher, the juice on this thing comes out only on one side. A higher morality. I look at the Grisham books that I've read, and I haven't read all of them, but that's one of the things that attracts me, is that the good is going to win out here. We're going to defeat these evil turkeys. And anything else?
There's going to be a solution. This is the hook, sort of, all of these things, but it's going to build up to a reasonable resolution.
T.T., you know, you know what I mean. Is it great? Are John Grisham books great? Anybody here an English major in college? Did you read them? No. Why not? I mean, that's not because my teacher didn't assign them. That's right. So what does it take to move out of the John Grisham level? The Minchner, I asked that before, a lot of you read a Minchner book. What does it take to move out of that? Are you going to read The Covenant twice? What else do we look for when we turn to something to say, I want this to help explain my life?
And I'm looking at this. Reynolds Price is my favorite author. Doesn't do any action. I mean, it just seems like none of those things are in.
I don't know. Reynolds Price, does he write fiction?
Yes, he does. Yeah. Kate Vaden was a book that he wrote several years ago. But it's like the characters in it aren't my life, but he writes my life. So it's a relational thing without all the action and high morals. And
so the complexity of the character, would that cover years?
Yeah, in real
that
simple
character is
southern
so,
rural settings.
Yeah.
Again, though, do we pick up a book to think, to be challenged, to look for issues? Or do we pick up a book just to enjoy reading for reading's sake? Maybe it has a plot, maybe it doesn't. I'm a big fan of the Cancun Mysteries, you know, Lillian Jackson Braun. There's no redeeming value in them except they're good stories. Mm-hmm.
And the answer to your question is yes. We do pick them up for that, of course.
Oh.
And that's good, I suppose. I do it too. I mean, I like James Bond movies. But not as much as I like Sophie's Choice. Well, I'm going to suggest to you that one of the things that happens here in the Old Testament stories, and you can look at all of the stories that way, is the depths they take the human condition to. Listen to this piece of music, and then listen to an excerpt from Sophie's Choice. Final aria from Handel's Messiah, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. And the words are real clear here, so I don't have to. The worms destroy this body. Flesh will I see God. The argument that my colleagues and I had about Sophie's Choice, there's a lot of a pretty explicit and anatomical sex in the book. I coach track two, and I might be the only track team in the United States that sits around talking about books. And I was talking about that, and he said, what page is that on? What course is that in? I'm going to take that course. And sometimes they do. Sophie's Choice, and there are, this is what it looks like in our, they gave me a copy over there to bring over here. This is what it looks like over in the bookstore, in case you want to go run and buy it. It's the story of a woman who has survived Auschwitz. And in the process of her surviving, she's lost immeasurably. And I won't go into the specifics of that to ruin this plot. But the story of her losses is unfolded to us, as readers, gradually. And it's unfolded to us through the eyes of a young writer called Stingo. And Stingo, in the beginning of the book, says, I'm going on this voyage of discovery. He opens the book, second paragraph, his first line is, call me Stingo. A line that is familiar to those of you who have read Moby Dick, call me Ishmael. And Ishmael is what in the Old Testament? The great wanderer, the guy that's lost in the wilderness, and Ishmael is lost in the wilderness searching out for, you know, the struggles of good and evil that are in Moby Dick. And Styron in Sophie's Choice calls us, harks back to that, call me Stingo. And he says about, Stingo does, and he's, I think, is speaking for us when he says, it was true I had traveled great distances for one so young, he had been in the army, but my spirit had remained landlocked, unacquainted with love, and all but a stranger to death. That's early in the book. And we know that some of this is going to be a part of Stingo's life. And it's also going to be a part, I would contend, a part of our life. And this is the, I guess, the thing that I wanted to point out about the power of literature, whether it's the Bible or any great literature, is that we go on this journey too. And as William Faulkner says, something is created that did not exist before. And this something is an awareness of Stingo's journey, as well as, I guess candidly, love for Sophie. This is a woman that you will love after you get to know her. We've all had characters like that. Well, I played that song because Sophie, who has survived Auschwitz, has lost a lot, but most of all what she's lost is what Melville refers as beyond the pasteboard mask, something beyond, into, away from human experience into the divinity. Where is God? And Sophie says, you just heard that song, and I'm sure that that almost all of you have heard it many, many times and could sing along with it. And Sophie, who speaks with a heavy accent, so Stingo, I have lived with this very, very strong guilt which I can't lose, even though I know it has no reason. Like that Jewish woman in Sweden said when she tried to make me see that the love we had, she's talking about her husband who was killed in the Holocaust, that we had was the most important thing, not the silly fight. But I still have this strong guilt. Funny, Stingo, you know I have learned to cry again, and I think perhaps that means I am a human being again. Perhaps that at least. A piece of a human being. This is early in the book. But a piece of a human being, but yes, a human being. Often I cry alone when I listen to music, which remind me of Krakow, and she's Polish and she's not Jewish. Remind me of Krakow and those past years. And you know, there is one piece of music that I cannot listen to. It makes me cry so much my nose stops up. I cannot breathe. My eyes run like streams. It is in these Handel records I got for Christmas. I know that my Redeemer liveth that make me cry, because of all my guilt, and also because I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God. I can hardly read that. I've read it I don't know how many times. It takes us beyond the pasteboard mask, for Melville. It takes us into some dimension of life that's beyond just a philosophical treatise or a social tract that maybe, in a way, and I teach it, and I think it's a great book, that maybe Native Son is. This is a story about oppression in America, and it's bigger than that, and there is a little bit of stepping beyond the pasteboard mask, but you have to really work to get it. And so we read Native Son. It's a good book. It's a really good book. But it doesn't go as far as Sophie's Choice does, into the complexity of something that's beyond just this social or political sense of who we are in the society. We know, and there are all kinds of social criticisms in Sophie's Choice, but the fundamental issue for Sophie, you just heard it. I've lost my God. It's apostasy. And how do I deal with that, Stingo? It's not that I've lost, and I'm not going to list them for you, all these things that she's lost that are both intimate and personal as well as loving relationships. I've lost God. And you just heard it. What is it then about any of the great things that we've looked at through our experiences, and that we decide, this book I will go back to again and again and again, and this book I'm going to read and I'm going to enjoy it, I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to like it, and it's going to fulfill my day for that reason, but thank you, I'm done. That's how I am with the James Bond movies. Thank you, I like that, and I checked out for a few hours, but I'm not going to watch it again. Well, maybe I will. So take this notion and see if now if we can, and I've got some more excerpts from Sophie's Choice, if we can take, what is it that it takes to touch us in the deepest parts of our being, in our soul? Let me, go ahead.
For me, I think a book that really seems to me important and lasting requires a lot of work for me. And I don't know whether, maybe that's a process of having to reflect upon my own attitudes and thinking and how what I'm encountering in the book changes those or challenges them. And I don't read books like that on long airplane trips where I'm just trying to survive. I read some easy adventure and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I always have to work at it.
Yeah, and very good. We give something, we process something, it's by our working at it, we've invested something too. And it seems to matter. And I suspect that the way most of us have always read the stories, many of the stories of the Bible, we really don't invest much. I mean, sometimes we do, and I can't speak for anyone else, but some stories we read, I mean, what do we invest when we read Jonah? Well, I would suggest to you read it again and invest something. And it's a tremendous story about somebody who's, you know, so unwilling, they'll give up anything, but not their concept of God. That has just been bashed to all smithereens. Hey, this is not how God is, says God to Jonah, but Jonah won't give it up. Well, that's a whole other complexity to that story. Because if we work at it, we give something, we process something.
When I read something again, it isn't so that I make sure I have the details right or the order of it right. It's because I'm either going to want to capture what I got the first time,
yep,
or see what it says this time.
See what it says, and is it fair to add, see what it does?
Yeah.
To you,
yeah.
Too? So one of the things...
Yeah, what it does to me, yeah.
One of the things that we look for is that our motions are struck. I've read that a lot of times, and I had a hard time getting through it. You did too, didn't you? Just hearing that. But Dallas struck our emotions. You know, that doggone JR, I hate him. but he did, I mean, are you going to go watch Dallas reruns? Anybody? Don't admit it. because this is not enough to satisfy the complexity of the human experience that we want to we want to connect to, not necessarily identify with. You will not be able to identify with Sophie. Her grief is past anything, anybody. I mean, the imaginative work, and that's another word I guess I would put up here, imagination. And lots of English poets argue that that's where the truth is found, in the imaginative thinking of humankind. Well, our emotions are struck. I just thought of when I wrote that word up on the board of a thing that I used to do with we have two sons, and when they were little, we'd read the Dr. Seuss stuff and lots of things, and I remember this one, of course. Hi diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon, the little dog laughed to see such a sport, and the dish ran away with a spoon. We love it. And say it again, Dad! And it bounces in its rhythm, and it somehow touches us. I mean, I'm saying physical because of the rhythms of it. But think about that little ditty. Hi diddle diddle, what's that? Anybody can image that? Of course not. If you can't, talk to me. It would be therapy. Hi diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle. Okay, you can see that. Those are images. The cat and the fiddle. The cow jumped over the moon. I can tell you that a long time ago that was satirical stuff. And it did have something to do with the government of England. But we don't know that now. We just have hi diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle. The cow jumped over the moon. Visualize that now. And the cow jumps over the moon. The little dog laughed to see such a sport, and the dish ran away with a spoon. My kids at 22 and 21 now, they don't read that poem anymore. It doesn't do enough for us, does it? My point is the complexity of our being has to be touched at every level. So we can touch ourselves physically, we can touch ourselves emotionally. How else? I mean, we can touch ourselves. The psychology, one of my favorite authors is William Styron. He wrote Sophie's Choice, as I've said 16 times already. His great book, Darkness Visible, about depression, it's fantastic. And it deals into the depths of psychology and emotions, but it doesn't touch much on one other level. Beyond and it's got to be there, doesn't it? This spiritual level, beyond the pasteboard mask, what Parlagerfist, the great Swedish writer, calls the divine, as opposed to saying God, which in his mind is a creation of humankind. The divine is something that really exists, and it isn't any one of his phrases, an abomination of human imagination. It's true. So it has to get there, doesn't it? And the physical, the emotional, the psychological, the spirit, the social. When I was in college, it was a big kind of, the thing that we were taught is people are going to go out to teach high school kids anyway. Read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Great book. Anybody read it? You know, it's about, of course, the social injustice, Grapes of Wrath, although it goes a little further. Those books aren't around anymore. They haven't endured, as your phrase, durable was your word, or endured. They haven't sustained themselves because somehow they fall short. Well, the stuff in here hasn't fallen short. But I suspect that readers sometimes, if we forget the dimensions that we're trying to experience, then we make this book fall short by our own reading, not our reading ability, but our reading consciousness. Let's go on just for a second with a couple more excerpts from Sophie's Choice. I want you to go read it. This is a guy, a white guy, whose character is not Jewish, who survives the Holocaust, and here's one of his, I'm going to put this on and skip some time, a higher our students in that class decided that a book to be great has to somehow deal with higher morality. It has to raise our moral consciousness. In Sophie's Choice, there's a lot of stuff in it about slavery and about, of course, the evil of the Holocaust. And here's Styron, or the narrator, about the Holocaust. There's 500 pages of this kind of thing. It is a liberal fallacy that equates the military mind with real evil and makes it the exclusive province of lieutenants or generals. The secondary evil of which the military is frequently capable is aggressive, romantic, melodramatic. Think of the James Bond and the Clint Eastwood movies. Aggressive, romantic, melodramatic, thrilling, orgasmic, but real evil. The suffocating evil of Auschwitz is gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring, and it was perpetrated almost exclusively by civilians. That's a moral consciousness that the book brings to us about our participation as readers, either by neglect or by condoning or by deliberate participation. All of these things, neglect, condoning, and participating, are what Sophie experiences herself as she tries to save herself from the horrors of the Holocaust. And early in the book, if you look at it at all, Stengel himself gets fired from a job. This is page 18 of the novel. "I notice you don't wear a hat," his boss, he calls him the weasel. "I notice you don't wear a hat," the weasel said. "A hat?" I replied. "Well, why, no." "Well, everyone at McGraw-Hill wears a hat." "Everyone?" I replied. "Everyone," he said flatly. And of course, I reflected on what he was saying. I realized that it was true. Everyone did wear a hat. In the morning, in the evening, and at lunchtime, the elevators and hallways were bobbing seas of straws and felts, all perched on the uniformly sheared, closely cropped scalps of McGraw-Hill's 1,000 regimented minions. This was at least true for men. For the women, mainly secretaries, it seemed to be optional. Stengel says to him, "May I ask in what other way I haven't fitted the profile?" "I cannot dictate your newspaper reading habits, nor do I want to, but it is not wise for a McGraw-Hill employee to be seen with a copy of the New York Post." He paused. "This is simply advice for your own good. Needless to say, you can read anything you want to, on your own time and in privacy. It just does not look, well, seemly for McGraw-Hill editors to be reading radical publications at the office." "Well, what should I be reading then?" "The Herald Tribune might be more appropriate." My point in that silly kind of non-emotional episode is that Stengel gets fired for reading the wrong newspapers and wearing the wrong hat. And the first time I ever wrote Sophie's Choice, I wrote in the margin, "Weasel is the first Nazi that we meet in this book." And our consciousness, and early in the book, is slowly touched by what is it that, or how is it that we participate or condone or inadvertently participate in evil? By the way we think about how the world, you don't wear a hat. And it's later in the book where the woman, the guy that has control over Sophie's life, the commandant at Auschwitz, she says to him, "Can you let my son go?" he's not Jewish. He's got blue eyes and blonde hair. He'd be great for the Lebensborn program, the Hitler for Youth program. "Can you let him go?" And this guy who burns 900 Jews a day in the furnaces of Auschwitz says, "Why, Sophie, that would be unlawful." Compare that with Weasel. It's so obvious to us by the time we're meeting Rudolf Hess, the commandant, the actual historical figure, meeting the imaginative Sophie. It's impossible for us to identify with Hess and being in control of burning 900 people a day. But it's not impossible to identify with Sophie. With the Weasel and that kind of participation even. But unconscious participation in a way of thinking that is really, as I said in my margin, the first Nazi. Stengel experiences or becomes aware of all of this, and the end of the book is this. And it has to do with what you guys have called a resolution. I can't find it. I Xeroxed those because I thought it would be easier. Stengel, after much has happened, and I don't want to give away that part of the plot, looks back in his journal, he's a writer, remember, and he pulls out three truths that he's learned from his association with Sophie. Truth number one is, "Someday I will understand Auschwitz." This was a brave statement, but innocently absurd. No one will ever understand Auschwitz. What I might have set down with more accuracy would have been, Someday I will write about Sophie's life and thereby help demonstrate how absolute evil is never extinguished from the world. Auschwitz itself remains inexplicable. The most profound statement yet made about Auschwitz was not a statement at all, but a response. The query, at Auschwitz, tell me, where was God? And the answer, where was man? The second line, and so we're introduced again or reminded of all the complex experiences that have gone on for Sophie and for us as we've encountered the Holocaust and the unthinkable evil that that brings to us. Something that we cannot possibly imagine, but through the character, the imagination of Styron and his character Sophie that we now maybe don't identify with, but for sure care about, have been touched in a way that raises our moral consciousness. The book ends, and I don't know quite how to do this. I don't think it spoils the book. In fact, it probably helps. And you can kill me if you want to. Sophie has no choice in life but to commit suicide. Life has been just too painful. And she dies. And if you've seen the movie, this goes on, but you don't get it in the movie. It's there, but you'll never know it. She dies after committing suicide, or while committing suicide, listening. She puts on the record. She loves classical music. And this is what she has playing on the record as she commits suicide. What's the title of that? Jesus, joy of man's desire. This is the woman who's lost God. Context of where is God in all this, and how does God or the divine touch the human experience, and what, as Styron says through his narrator, what has stopped up this God from penetrating the human experience has been, he calls it this, Auschwitz was like some giant embolism in the bloodstream of humankind stopping up God's titanic love. This book, and there are lots of them like it, then you know which ones they are. But it fits the criteria that you, together, we've established as what makes something great. And then the last question, and it will stop for sure, is does it matter to our faith what we read? And does it matter what we have our kids read? And does it matter, and that's not a kid's book for a long shot, but good stuff touches us one way, great stuff touches us another. And it can enhance and enrich faith in ways that, I mean, some great books can, and in ways that others cannot. And anybody have anything they want to say? Well, time to eat. Anybody? Sophie's Choice is on sale. The bookstore. And I looked in the library. If it is there, it's off right now. Good job, you're
thank you.
Thoughtful audience. Thank you.